The American History Podcast, Season 1, Episode 9, The Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay Colonies.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Hello, and welcome to the American History Podcast. Originally, this was recorded and published in the winter of 2018. However, as you're probably aware by now, I wasn't happy with those early episodes. First, I didn't quite know what I was doing, and secondly, the sound was often poor, as I'm not a sound engineer. Since then, or so I'd like to think, I've improved my game, and I've acquired a sound editor. So, in celebration of our third anniversary, I'm re-recording the entirety of Season 1. Now, in many cases, the episodes are exactly as they were originally written. This, however, is not the case with this one. I've combined two episodes into one, so this episode will be slightly longer than my original goal of keeping the episodes at 20 minutes in length. I guess it doesn't matter too much, as I rarely hit the target of 20 minutes anyways. So, with that said, on with the show. Today we continue the story of the New England colonies in the 17th century. And before we get started, as always, I'd like to invite you to follow the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter at American Hiscast. You can also go to the website where you'll find the sources that I've used to create the episodes. You can also sign up for the email list, which allows you to get email updates whenever a new episode is released. Now, the first colony founded in New England was the Plymouth Colony, founded by the group of people we know as the Pilgrims. The Pilgrims were actually the first wave of separatists who had left Britain for Holland, where they felt they would be able to practice Calvinism in the way they wanted. Led by Reverend John Robinson, they would soon become unhappy with the Dutchification of their children. They wanted, most of all, the chance to practice their religion as Englishmen without interference from others, and without having to see their children infected by the pop culture around them. Thus, the separatists secured rights to settle within the Virginia Company's jurisdiction in Virginia. The agreement was that the Pilgrims would work for 7 years in return for the support of the joint stock company, which was made up of non-separatist investors. After 7 years, any profit realized by the venture would be shared between the settlers and the investors. Now, while religion was a motivating factor in the settlement of the Pilgrims in the New World, it also had an economic aspect which is sometimes forgotten or overlooked. The idea was, of course, that the Pilgrims would practice their religion while, at the same time, providing profit for themselves and the Virginia Company. The plan was for the Mayflower to set sail for North America in early September. Now, if you're paying any attention to the weather off the eastern coast of the United States, the late summer, early fall can be an interesting time. In September of 1620, the weather was, to say the least, non-cooperative, and sailing the North Atlantic was quite dangerous. Nonetheless, the ship set sail from Plymouth on September 6, 1620. There were 102 passengers, plus about 30 officers and sailors on board. The voyage was, quite honestly, miserable for the passengers. And finally, on November 9th, 1620, the ship sighted present-day Cape Cod. Now, realizing they were far north of their intended landfall, the ship attempted to head south, to no avail. The heavy seas forced the ship to return to Cape Cod, and on November 11th, they dropped anchor. Some historians have suggested that the Pilgrims hijacked the ship, and, in order to gain the consent of the non-separatists, issued the Mayflower Compact. Now, whatever the case may be, the settlers eventually chose Plymouth Bay as their initial settlement site. This had been an American Indian community ravaged by a great plague a few years earlier, suggesting that the natives in this area had contact with Europeans or with other natives who had contact with Europeans. Now, because Plymouth was outside the jurisdiction of the Virginia Company, the settlers were squatters. They had no legal right to the land and no recognized government. They were not authorized to settle in this area, which explains why they never gained a charter from the Crown. I mentioned the Mayflower Compact a few moments ago, so let's briefly discuss it. It was not a constitution, but an agreement. The purpose of the compact was to legitimize the fact that the settlers had created a colony outside Virginia by creating a secular document recognizing James I as their sovereign and creating a body of all the settlers with power to devise laws and elect leaders. Now, this is interesting to me because, at the end of the day, this is a group of separatists. They wanted separation from England and from others whom they found were impure, thus the name Puritan. However, at the time, they appear worried about legitimacy in the eyes of the English monarchy. So there's this odd psychosis, at least in my mind, about their actions. Now, another little interesting aspect of the Plymouth colony is that because it would never possess a royal charter, it eventually merged with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The agreement provided for majority rule amongst the settlers, and some argue it was an important seed of democracy in North America. The adult male settlers assembled to make laws and conduct open discussion town meetings. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that New England did play a role in the idea of democracy in the Americas. However, remember, this is after the Virginia House of Burgesses had already begun meeting, so to give all of the credit to New England is, in my mind, out of bounds. That first winter, the winter of 1620 through 21, was terrible. First, by December, many of the passengers and crew were ill with scurvy and severe coughs. During that first winter, about half the members of the expedition died. By late December, the pilgrims had crossed over to the mainland and surveyed the area that became the Plymouth settlement. This was originally a native village known as Patuxet to the Wampanoag people, but had been abandoned about 3 years earlier after a plague killed all of the residents. Referred to as Indian fever by historians in the 19th century, it is now believed that they suffered from an outbreak of smallpox that was introduced by European traders. The local population of natives was so weakened by the disease, the colonists faced no resistance to their settlement. The first construction began almost immediately, and by mid-January, a common house was completed, 20 feet square for general use. It quickly became a hospital for the ill colonists, 31 of whom died by the 1st of March. Things were so bad that at one point, only 6 or 7 of the colonists were able to feed and care for the rest of their fellows. The death toll rose, and Coles Hill, a prominent nearby overlook, became the first European cemetery in New England. Now on that happy note, a brief word about relations with the Native Americans. Squanto, the last or one of the last of the Patuxet people, living in southern New England, and remember, they were wiped out by smallpox, acted as a liaison between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags, a tribe who controlled the region. Squanto lived an interesting life. He was kidnapped along with 27 other natives and taken to Spain, where they were sold into slavery. Eventually, Squanto escaped to England, the story of which is unknown, and made his way back to the New World, specifically Newfoundland. From there, he would be taken back to his native village in 1619, which by this point was ravaged by disease. He then lived amongst the, the Pokanoket, eventually coming into contact with the colonists from the Mayflower. And because he was the only Indian who was familiar with English, he played a key role in the meetings between the Pilgrims and the natives that took place in 1621. Eventually, he became attached to the English settlers and assisted the colonists in planting native vegetables, and he also introduced them to the fur trade. And of course, Squanto's life comes to a tragic end in November 1622, when he contracted what the Plymouth governor, William Bradford, referred to as the Indian fever. Now, before we leave Squanto, it should be noted that he and Bradford had grown to be close friends, and Bradford remained with Squanto during his final days. Now, by the fall of 1621, thanks to the help offered to the colonists by Squanto and other local natives, 20 acres of corn were under cultivation, and in November of 1621, 53 colonists were alive to celebrate the harvest. It would not be known as Thanksgiving until 2 years later, in 1623. Nonetheless, what the Pilgrims did was to adopt the Indians' traditional custom of giving thanks at the time of the fall harvest. There are 3 contemporaneous accounts of the event that have survived, and the event was celebrated by the 53 colonists and 90 of the Wampanoags. Apparently, the celebration lasted 3 days and featured a feast which included numerous variations of waterfowl, wild turkey, and fish that were procured by the colonists, as well as 5 deer brought by the Indians. Now, I know there is, to some extent, a belief that the Europeans mistreated the Indians, and while this might be true generally speaking, the fact is that this is not true for every case and at all times. In fact, an alliance was formed by the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags for mutual protection against other Indian tribes, and the peace between the two groups would last for 4 decades, until the death of Massasoit, the Wampanoag leader, in 1662. Now, I'm in no way saying that Europeans were benevolent, or even good neighbors, but I am saying that at different times and in different locations, relations between Europeans and Indian tribes weren't as bad as Hollywood would have us believe. While the Pilgrims had a rough start to life in North America, they did become successful. They developed an economy based on fur trading, fishing, and lumber. 1627 would see the arrival of cattle in the colony and marked an upturn in economic conditions, according to historians James Dietz and Patricia Dietz in their work The Times of Their Lives, Life, Love, and Death in the Plymouth Colony. Beside cattle, the colony, by 1630, also had pigs, sheep, and goats. Now, having said that, religion remained paramount in the colony. Interestingly, one of the most important religious figures in the colony was John Robinson, who actually never set foot in New England. His ideology and pronouncements on theological issues gave Plymouth its nature and character in the early years. Robinson made pronouncements such as women and men have different social roles according to the laws of nature, although neither is lesser in the eyes of God. He referred to women as the weaker vessel and pronounced that it was the role of males to educate and guide the community. Finally, he also believed women should be subject to their husbands. The community, however, was led by the previously mentioned William Bradford for many years. He was the elected governor, and, in order to encourage farming, he distributed land amongst the settlers. A member of the original group of separatists, Bradford was a signatory to the Mayflower Compact. Like many of the colonists, he would know hardship and loss, having his first wife, Dorothy May Bradford, fall overboard on the Mayflower while at anchor and drown. Of course, he would also lose his closest friend Squanto in the fall of 1622. Another important leader of the colony at this time was Miles Standish. He was a military man hired to protect the Pilgrims. Standish, like Bradford, was also part of the original group of separatists. He led an expedition against the Massachusetts Indians at the behest of Massasoit. As another example of the complicated relationship between Europeans and Indians, Standish was criticized by Pastor John Robinson for his brutality toward the natives. Bradford himself, while deferring to Standish, was uncomfortable with the way he treated the Massachusetts people. The consequences were such that natives throughout the region abandoned their villages, and the Pilgrims had difficulty for some time when attempting to trade with Indians. Massasoit was also disturbed by the behavior of his European allies, but he would continue to honor the treaty until his death in 1622. In 1691, the colony had 7,000 people, but was smaller than the larger MBC, with whom it merged. There are two reasons for this merger. First, the Pilgrims did not have their own charter. They were still, in essence, squatters. Secondly, the MBC had its own charter revoked, and the Crown was seeking to unify both colonies for administrative purposes. Now, speaking of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it was founded in 1629 by non-separatist Puritans who were afraid for both their future and that of England. Now, why were they in fear? Well, this is the reign of Charles I, the second monarch in the Stuart line, and a firm believer in the divine right of kings. When you add this to the fact that he was married to a Roman Catholic, and his actions, which were seen as those of an absolute monarch, which is an anathema to the English, it meant there was going to be trouble. Charles ended up dismissing Parliament in 1629 and sanctioning an anti-Puritan purge in the kingdom. Before this, the moderate Puritans had gathered support in Parliament to enact reforms, but with the monarch refusing to guarantee the power of Parliament or the basic rights of the people, the situation was on the knife's edge, so to speak. Now, it was in this environment that the Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded. Before they set sail for the New World, the shareholders of the MBC in Cambridge signed what was called the Cambridge Agreement, which led to the founding of Boston. It turned the corporate charter into a government that served as the constitution for the MBC for many years. The result of this is that the Puritans were now able to remove themselves from the control of the king and the Church of England, which they regarded as little better than the Roman Catholic Church. By 1631, 2,000 colonists had arrived in Boston and had created a number of settlements around it. As England devolved into turmoil during the 1630s, 15,000 more immigrants would arrive in New England, and approximately 60,000 others would settle in colonies throughout North America and the West Indies. The Great Migration ended in the 1640s with the outbreak of the English Civil War, as Puritans decided to remain in England and fight the Royalist forces. Led by Oliver Cromwell, they were victorious, and Charles surrendered to a Scottish army, which eventually handed him over to the English Parliament. Of course, Charles wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, and he refused his captors' demands to create a constitutional monarchy. Choosing instead to try and continue the fight, Charles escaped in 1647, was recaptured and imprisoned on the Isle of Wight, eventually being tried and executed for high treason in January 1649. Now, back in New England, John Winthrop was the governor of the MBC. Winthrop was a firm believer in what is referred to as covenant theology. He believed that Puritans had a covenant with God to lead a new religious experiment in the New World. It was Winthrop who wrote the famous phrase, "We shall build a city upon a hill," in a model of Christian charity, as he was sailing to Massachusetts Bay. Now, this sermon is often credited as the precursor to the idea of American exceptionalism. And while I think it is true, especially since modern neocons love to quote it as justification for American imperial activities on the world stage, the fact is that, at the time of its delivery, it was not given the attention that you might think. Further, he was not introducing new concepts, nor was he, I would argue, suggesting that they should build an imperial edifice. Instead, Winthrop was simply repeating widely held Puritan beliefs. This was not a clarion call to build an American empire. What we can say about John Winthrop is that his leadership helped the colony to grow and become a success. Indeed, the MBC became the largest and most influential colony in New England. Its economy was based on fishing, shipbuilding, the fur trade, lumbering, and some dairy farming, and even some small farming of wheat and corn. Certainly, location also played a role in this success, but Winthrop's leadership also had a part to play, and going forward, the MBC and New England would play an important role in American history, for better or worse. Now, in the MBC, office holding was open to all free male adults, which was 2/5 of the population, belonging to the Puritan congregation. This immediately brings up the question, just how democratic was the MBC? The common misconception is that New England was extremely democratic, whilst other regions, especially the South, were less so. I think you can tell that it was democratic so long as you were a member of the club being the Congregational Church. Now, having said that, if you compared New England to, say, England, the percentage of eligible office holders was greater in Massachusetts. So, as always, it simply depends on the context. Compared to the modern United States, New England was not at all democratic. If you compare it to England during the 17th century, then the MBC comes out on top. Now, I've mentioned the Congregational Church briefly, so let's delve deeper into that organization. As a part of American history, the Congregational Churches had an important effect on the religious and the political history of the country. It has also had an effect on the educational establishment, as universities, such as Harvard and Yale, were originally created to train congregational clergy. The Congregationalists also had influence on the First and Second Great Awakenings, and they were early promoters of the 19th century missionary movement. Eventually, the Puritan churches in New England collectively grew into the Congregational Church. Historian James F. Cooper notes, Congregationalism helped to instill the political culture in Massachusetts with important ideas, such as adherence to fundamental or higher laws, strict limits on all human authority, and the idea of local self-government. Now, eventually, Puritan churches grew collectively into the entity known as the Congregational Church. Each community organized a church of believers, those who were considered to be amongst the elect, and they could give the other members a testimony of their conversion experience. Each church was built upon a covenant, a written agreement that each member signed and agreed to uphold the principles of the church. The idea was they would not only abide by the principles, but they would be guided by scripture in their decision-making process. Further, each congregation was a separate entity and expected to elect officers and basically manage its own affairs. As for the actual politics, in 1631, Puritan men gained the right to vote. The vote only extended to believers. Non-religious men and all women were not given the chance to vote. Having said that, this is still a revolutionary idea. Instead of decision-making being in the hands of a few elite families, you get the start of modern ideas on voting right being a right that extends to all. Now, as for decision-making, town hall meetings emerged as the centerpiece of the New England town and as a staple of democracy in the area. Town governments allowed all male property holders and other times other residents to vote and publicly discuss the issues, which were decided upon by a majority rule, basically a show of hands in favor of the measure. What was the purpose of government according to the Puritans? The purpose was to enforce God's laws, also known as covenant theology. We're not going to get into covenant theology, as it's quite complicated, but it is a framework for biblical interpretation, something which the Puritans were quite concerned with, as were all Protestants. Now, I know I mentioned democracy just a moment ago, but realize that the provincial government under John Winthrop was not a democracy. Firstly, only Puritans or the visible saints could be free men, and only free men could vote. So just keep that in mind, and don't think that they were allowing just anyone to vote, even if the person was male. They had to be Puritan. Secondly, the governor himself hated the idea of democracy and distrusted anyone who was not a Puritan. Thirdly, the Congregational Church was established. It was tied into the government, and all believers were required to pay taxes to the government-supported church. Fourthly, anyone who was a religious dissenter was punished. New England was the least tolerant colony with regards to religious freedom. Now, as for leadership and its tactics, they controlled the membership by conducting public interrogations of anyone who claimed to have had a conversion experience. Oddly, John Cotton, the preeminent minister and theologian in the colony, was devoted to defending the government's duty to enforce religious rules, yet, at the same time, advocated a civil government. Also of note is the fact that the clergymen were not allowed to hold public office. So while government and religion were tied in together, there was already the beginnings of a division or a separation between the two. That brings us to how the congregation operated day to day, so to speak. A congregation could hire and fire ministers and set the salaries of the clergy. This was not in the hands of government. Puritans had, in fact, learned their lesson in England when they suffered at the hands of the political Anglican clergy in England. They were not about to suffer under such a regime anytime soon. Interestingly, or at least interestingly to me, was something called the Cambridge Platform in 1648. This was the four Puritan colonies, the MBC, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven, organizing a congregation form of church government. The significance of this is that the congregational church became more uniform throughout New England. This meant that you had an increase in regional identity throughout much of the New England area. Now, one of the things that we have yet to explore is the idea of religious dissenters. It might appear that everyone was on the same page and pulling in the same direction, so to speak, but nothing could be further from the truth. First, Quakers, who believe in an inner light and not in theology, flouted the authority of the Puritan clergy and ended up being persecuted. Now, just a side note, the Quakers are my kind of people. Flouting the authorities and marching to the beat of your own drum, that's right up my alley. Apparently, so is being persecuted, but that's a story for another day. Sadly, some Quakers were actually publicly executed. Now, also, along the same lines of dissenters, you have Anne Hutchison. She believed in something called antinomianism. She argued and promulgated the idea that the elect didn't need to obey the laws of man. They were predestined for salvation, so what's the point of obeying the laws of men? You are predestined to go to heaven. It's already been decided. That's not where her radical ideas ended. She also had the audacity to hold prayer meetings at her house and discuss the sermons of John Cotton with other women. This was taboo for someone who was not a member of the clergy. Thus, she was accused of heresy, or wrong practice, and brought to trial in 1638. In the trial, Anne claimed that she had direct revelation from God. This made it even worse, as this is considered an even more grievous heresy. She was banished from the colony and set out for Rhode Island. It is believed today that her trial may have been politically motivated, since some who supported Anne politically opposed the present leadership of the colony. This brings us to Roger Williams. He was an extreme separatist who challenged the legality of the Plymouth and MBC charters because the land had belonged to Native Americans and was not the king's land to grant. He claimed the MBC took land from Indians without fair compensation. Williams argued he was governed by a liberty of conscience, or the freedom to follow one's own ethical and religious beliefs. Further, he claimed the government could only punish civil crimes, while it was the responsibility of the church to enforce religious discipline. He also argued that no man should be forced to go to church, in effect challenging the basis of the MBC government. This phrase would later be used by Jefferson in the early 19th century, and it is somewhat controversial today. Now, I'm not a scholar of Jefferson, so I'll tread lightly here. I will say that everyone seems to focus on the first part of Jefferson's phrase. the no establishment of religion part, and ignores the second half, or the practice thereof. The general court banished him from the colony in October of 1635, and he fled in the winter of 1636 to Narragansett Bay, where he was sheltered by Native American friends. He then purchased lands from American Indians and founded the community of Providence, accepting all settlers, regardless of their beliefs. As you can probably imagine, Puritanism eventually began to decline. The first generation of Puritans began losing their zeal as time went on. Firstly, a large population influx dispersed the Puritan population onto outlying farms away from control of the church and neighbors. After the wave of dissension in the 1630s and 40s, conversions decreased dramatically. Children of non-converted members could not be baptized, so there was a built-in problem with the religion. Also, the Jeremiah taken from the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah was used by preachers to scold parishioners into being more committed to their faith. Conversions continued to abate as second-generation Puritans had trouble getting their conversions authenticated by the church, thus preventing their children from being baptized. In response, in 1662, the Halfway Covenant comes into being. This sought to attract more members by giving partial membership to the unconverted. The children of the Halfway members were allowed to be baptized. In other words, the leadership realized there was a built-in mechanism that was causing the church numbers to decline, and they tried to reverse the trend. By 1700, Puritan churches opened baptism to anyone who wanted it. Further effects of this was the distinction between the elect and other members of society being blurred. At this point, strict religious purity was sacrificed for wider participation, and women made up a larger percentage of congregations. Finally, the decline of Puritanism and the power of the clergy was symbolized by the Salem witch trials of 1692. As a matter of context, Massachusetts was suffering political, religious, and military upheaval that caused widespread paranoia and unrest. Many Europeans and colonists in the 16th and 17th centuries believed the devil worked through witches in the real world. The first accusation started when young girls, after listening to voodoo tales from an African servant, started acting oddly. The witch hunt resulted in a reign of terror after certain older women were accused of being witches. The accusers were young females from the poor western part of the community and accused the more prosperous people in the eastern part. After the trials, 20 people were executed, as was a dog. Cotton Mather, one of the most prominent clergymen in Massachusetts, tacitly supported the witch trials and weakened the prestige of the clergy. Well, that's all for this episode. I hope you found it fascinating and enlightening. Next time, we will discuss the relationship between the settlers and the Indians in New England. And I'm sure we, meaning me, will bust some myths and misconceptions that you have about the way New Englanders treated Native Americans. As always, feel free to visit the website, sign up for the email updates. You can also find me on Twitter, @AmericanHisCast. Until next time, have a great day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.